This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey everybody, how's it going? Thanks for joining me this afternoon. I am Oren McIntyre. So a subject that I've touched on previously in another video is the concept of accelerationism. I've done an entire series on Nick Land and the many ideas that he has contributed, particularly in the political theory area called neo-reactionary theory. He's well known in that sphere, and he's written a lot when it comes to politics. And one of the ideas that he's discussed is accelerationism. Like I said, I did a short explainer on that previously. It was only about 6 or 7 minutes of the actual explanation. It's one of my most widely viewed videos, but this is a very complicated topic. And so while I'm proud of that video, I'm glad that I made it and so many people enjoyed it and got an introduction to what accelerationism is in that video, I've been meaning to go back and do a deeper dive on it because I think it's something that only increases in importance, a concept that is only having more impact on our daily lives. And I think it's worth diving into an understanding at a deeper level. And so this is kind of my first step into exploring the idea in more detail. And that means I'm going to not just give you that quick and dirty explanation, but ironically, I'm going to read an essay by Nick Land, which is kind of the foundational text of accelerationism. It's called A Quick and Dirty Introduction to Accelerationism, but I'm going to take my time with it this time instead of just going through it and boiling it down to the most basic terms like I did originally. I want to go ahead and do a deep dive so we can understand all the different facets of this and explore a little more. I also want to go ahead and clarify a few things about what accelerationism is, because a lot of people have misunderstandings. The terminology is thrown around a lot. And so I want to explain what he's talking about specifically here and kind of clarify that for a lot of people. But before we do, guys, let me tell you about your absolute moral duty to hire based people through New Founding. Hey guys, I need to tell you about today's sponsor, New Founding Talent. Look, we all know that the job market is a disaster right now. Based people can't find good companies to work for, and good companies can't find anybody to get the job done. The competency crisis is very, very real. So how do we get these two incredibly important groups together? We need organizations like New Founding. New Founding has created a network of high excellence professionals who are seeking to join grounded American businesses. These are individuals often in elite organizations who are ready for a team and a mission that supports their values instead of working against them. Aligned companies are already using this network to hire high-trust, exceptional individuals who can match the culture and mission of their teams. So if you're looking for better employees to build a better world, you need to go ahead and apply for access to the New Founding Talent Network at newfounding.com/talent. You'll get connected with candidates who will build your business. That's newfounding.com/talent. Check it out today. All right, so let's go ahead and talk about accelerationism. Now, just to clarify, like I said, first we need to lay the kind of the ground understanding of what we're talking about here. A lot of people will just talk about the idea of political accelerationism. And in that sense, what they're talking about is the idea that, well, things are going to fall apart. Things are going to collapse. There's going to be a fundamental breakdown of institutions, or in some way, things need to get worse before things can get better. Basically, the current system is unsalvageable, and so we need to go ahead and accelerate its demise so that we can bring about the institution of a new system. People will only go ahead and go along with the revolution or whatever if we accelerate how bad things are. That's what some people mean when they say accelerationism. Now, that is not what Nick Land is talking about here, or it's not strictly what Nick Land is talking about here. We'll get into the details again. This is the deep dive, so I can't break it all down at the very beginning, but that's not strictly what he's talking about here. Now, a few notes on political accelerationism. Now, I am someone who does think that our institutions are in pretty serious, in a pretty serious situation. In fact, I think one of the major problems, in fact, I addressed this on Twitter yesterday. A lot of people got very angry or got, you know, upset, whatever. But I think one of the major problems that people don't recognize is how many of our institutions have already failed. They have already gone through this process and they are just wearing the names of old institutions. We still pretend that they do what they used to do instead of doing what they actually do. And so people just don't recognize how many of our institutions have already failed and collapsed and are no longer doing what they're supposed to be doing. However, the point is that while I am someone who does think that our institutions are heading directly for the iceberg in a lot of ways, and they will have this problem, I am not someone who ever counsels the acceleration of that process in the sense that you would actually take steps to make things worse. And I think that's wrong on a lot of levels. First, I think it's morally wrong. I think it's morally wrong to accelerate the destruction of your own society, the worsening of your own society. I think that while you can recognize that a problem is happening and that something might be inevitable, hastening it, attempting to artificially hasten it by making things worse is personally immoral. I also think that there is a danger in assuming that you understand too much of a complicated process. So even if you think that institutions or systems might break down and that they might have to break down for something to change, that doesn't mean you understand the way in which that needs to happen or that you can somehow manufacture a better way of that. In fact, by attempting to accelerate it, you might break something fundamental to that process that makes the eventual restoration or revolution or whatever you're trying to bring about unable to happen, right? So you might break things in a way that you don't understand. This is always the danger, right? This is what the left does so often. They think they understand very complex systems, and they try to go ahead and gain mastery over them. They try to manipulate them when they don't really understand what they're doing. And so they make things much worse than they already are. And of course, that's actually the point of political accelerationism, is to make things specifically worse. And so there are many reasons that I think that's a bad idea, and I don't counsel it. But I want to be really clear, that's not what we're talking about here. What we're going to be talking about here is the problem of technological acceleration and what that does to the civilization that it's affecting, what it does to its ability to make decisions and govern itself and take action on its own behalf. And so these things overlap to some extent. You'll certainly see, especially when Nick Land talks about leftist acceleration and the things that they have tried to do or might want to do in order to bring about, you know, the Marxist utopia, that there are some echoes of political acceleration that people have taken out of this, but that is not what I really want to discuss here. What I really want to discuss is the problem of accelerationism, what it means for our ability to address things politically, to address things as a society, and to think about the problems that we're facing. So I'm going to go ahead and start reading the essay. And as I do so, I'll stop and we'll talk about the different aspects that we need to go ahead and explore. So, a quick and dirty introduction to accelerationism by Nick Land. Anyone trying to work out what they think about accelerationism better do so quickly. That's the nature of the thing. It is already caught up with trends that seemed too fast to track when it began and began to become self-aware decades ago. It's picked up a lot of speed since then. Accelerationism is old enough to have arrived in waves, which is to say incessantly or recurrently, and each time the challenge is more urgent. Among its predictions is the expectation that you'll be too slow to deal with it coherently. Yet if you fumble the question it poses, because rushed, you lose perhaps very badly. It's hard. For our purpose here, you are standing in as a bearer for the opinions of mankind. Time pressure, by its very nature, is difficult to think about. Typically, while the opportunity for deliberation is not necessarily presumed, is at least, with overwhelming likelihood, mistaken for a historical constant rather than a variable. If there's ever time to think, we think, there still is and will always be. The definite probability that the allotment of time to decision-making is undergoing systemic compression remains a neglected consideration, even among those paying explicit and exceptional attention to the increased rapidity of change. All right, so what does all that mean? He's starting out by explaining that accelerationism creates a problem. What we're looking at is the idea that we have to make decisions as a culture. We have to think about problems. And what we assume about thinking about a problem is that we'll always have time to do it. We'll always have time to consider and explore and discuss and deliberate issues, right? And so whenever we think about any problem, even when we think about the problem of things speeding up, we assume that we'll be able to address it. We'll be able, as a society, to think about it. Our institutions will be able to communicate about it and think things over. And the hive mind will come to a decision and we'll work through it. What he's presenting here is the fact that actually the space in which you make a decision, the space in which you deliberate and think about issues as a society, is not actually a constant. It's a variable. And if you're thinking about the fact that things are accelerating, that the rapidity of change is increasing, that probably means that the amount of time you have to think about problems is itself collapsing. It's reducing, which means you have a more and more limited amount of time to think about the fact that things are changing more and more. That's a huge problem. And even as you start to think about that problem, you realize that if things really are accelerating, oh no, we might actually be behind the eight ball about thinking about that problem in the first place. Continuing with the essay here. In philosophical terms, the deep problem of acceleration is transcendental. It describes an absolute horizon and one that is closing in. Thinking takes time, and accelerationism suggests that you're running out of time to think that through, if you haven't already. No contemporary dilemma is being entertained realistically until it's also acknowledging the opportunity for doing so is fast collapsing. So, just reiterating here the point that as we think about the fact that we are accelerating, that things are moving faster, we also have to acknowledge that the time in which we could actually address these things is collapsing. And so we have to get, if we're going to address these things at all, we have to get better at addressing them quickly. And it could be that, in fact, that has already escaped us. And that's something that we have to consider, or maybe we can't consider, which I know isn't something that's super comfortable to think about, but is something that might be true. Back to the essay here. The suspicion has to arrive that if a public conversation about acceleration is beginning, it's just in time to be too late. The profound and institutional crisis that makes the topic hot has at its core an implosion of social decision-making capability. Doing anything at this point would take too long. But instead, events increasingly just happen. They seem ever more out of control, even to a traumatic extent. Because the basic phenomenon appears to be a brake failure, accelerationism is picked up again. So, I don't think I'm the only one who feels those last words, right? That last phrase there, it really impacts you. So instead, events increasingly just happen. They seem ever more out of control, even to a traumatic extent. And doesn't that feel like where we're at right now? One of the things to think about here is the fact that we have increasingly distributed responsibility, decision-making responsibility in almost all of our structures. The bureaucratic oligarchic nature of our country, our politics, our corporations, everything. Everything in our society is built around these bureaucratic institutions that distribute decision-making capability as widely as possible. And the key to all of them is how deliberative the bodies are, right? In every case, you notice this, whether you're going to the DMV, you're calling customer service for your corporation, you're trying to get a bill through Congress, it's always impossible, right? Because you have to check with 1,000 people, 1,000,000 people. Everything needs to be kicked up to a manager. They have to check some kind of process. There's always, the decision can never be made by the person in front of you. It's always been distributed. The authority has been distributed. The responsibility has been distributed. The ability to reason through, rationally make decisions has been spread out among as many people as possible. And because of that fact, it's very difficult to make a decision quickly. But the problem is the issues we're facing keep coming at us faster and faster. So as the problems accelerate, our ability to make decisions dissipates, right? We've gotten worse and worse at making decisions quickly. And the things that are happening to us are happening to us faster and faster. And so instead of us making deliberate decisions as a society or even as individuals about what is happening to us, instead of that, it feels like things just happen, right? It feels like events just occur because they're moving too fast. They take on a life of their own because the bodies that are charged with being able to evaluate these things are moving too slowly to deal with the issues. Back to our essay here. Accelerationism links the implosion of decision space to the explosion of the world, that is, to modernity. It's important, therefore, to note that the conceptual opposition between implosion and explosion does nothing to impede their real mechanical coupling. The nuclear weapons provide the most vividly illuminating example. An H-bomb employs an A-bomb as a trigger. A fusion reaction sparks a fission reaction sparks a fusion reaction. The fusion mass is crushed into the ignition by a blast process. Modernity is a blast. So what's he saying here? He's saying as the world has exploded, as the, you know, and this is really what he, when he talks about modernity, he means the interconnection of everything, right? So we used to be a country on our own, right? But as we go ahead and connect our supply chains and connect our communications and become more and more reliant on foreign countries for production and energy, and we expect to be able to communicate everything, the more the world explodes, the more our ability to make decisions implodes. And that might feel like a counterintuitive, right? Like these two things, an explosion and implosion, they should be against each other. But he's saying, no, actually, even though it feels like they should be opposed, they actually are mechanically intertwined. The more the world explodes, the more the world is interconnected, the more that modernity asserts itself, the more our decision space, our time to make decisions actually implodes. And again, we can feel that because these trends seem to move across the world all at once. Think about the pandemic, right? That's kind of the perfect example where decisions to some extent did feel like they made themselves. Now we know that actually there's a lot of other organizations involved in that, right? And so we can get into a much larger discussion about how the WHO and other organizations actually made it feel that way. But the point is that the decision space collapses as the world interconnects. And he gives that example of the bombs as a way for us to understand why those two forces don't necessarily have to be opposed. This is all ready to be talking about cybernetics, which also returns incessantly in waves. It amplifies to a howl and then dissipates into the senseless babble of fashion until the next blast wave hits. Now you might say, Oren, what does this have to do with cybernetics? What are you talking about? We're going to get more into that in a second, but to just explain, a lot of people think, and I assumed this too before I started looking more into this stuff. The cybernetics just meant like working with androids or something, right? When you see cybernetics, that's usually what you think about, some kind of sci-fi, cyberpunk, cyborgs, whatever, right? Cybernetics, right? But that's not actually what cybernetics means. Cybernetics is the study of systems where the feedback or where the output is actually also an input. And so, for instance, you involve yourself in cybernetic processes all the time. For instance, let's say you're tilling a boat, right? You're on a boat and you're the one moving a boat and you're going down a river and you're constantly making small adjustments to your boat's direction. That, and you're learning during the process about how that works, and that's impacting. That's an example of cybernetics. And so you could also have that, of course, in a mechanical system where the mechanical system is getting feedback and it's learning and it's changing and it's changing course according to that feedback. That would also be a cybernetic system. So the cybernetics can be connected to technology. They often are. That's an important part of technology. But you can also be involved in a cybernetic process. And so when he's talking about cybernetics, he's going to talk about decision making, where you are having these, where the inputs are feeding back into themselves. So we're going to dive more into that and explain that in more detail in just a second, guys. But before we do, let's talk about New Foundings Venture Fund. Hey guys, I need to tell you about New Foundings Venture Fund. Look, we all know that the current system, the current companies out there, the current institutions, they're old, sick, dying, they're sclerotic, they're lame, they can't produce anything of value. And that means that young, talented, innovative people are trying to break out, break free. That's bad news for the establishment, but it's good news for us because that means those people are going to go out and found new companies, create new technologies, and figure out a way forward for our country. If you're interested in being a part of that exciting new future, then you need to check out the Venture Fund. New Founding has rallied the founders who have massive visions for a better future and is investing in these companies through its Venture Fund. The companies they invest in are defined by a simple question. Does the country we want to live in need the company this person is building? Look, venture investing isn't for everyone, but if you're a serious, accredited investor who wants to see a more hopeful future for this country, go to newfounding.com/venturefund and apply to be an investor. Again, that's newfounding.com/venturefund. All right, so let's get back into our essay here. For accelerationism, the crucial lesson was this. A negative feedback circuit, such as a steam engine governor or a thermostat, functions to keep some state of a system in the same place. Its product, in the language formulated by French philosophical cyberneticists Gilles Deleuze and Félix Guattari, is territorialization. Negative feedback stabilizes a process by correcting drift and thus inhibiting departure from a limited range. Dynamics are placed in the service of fixity, a higher level stasis or state. All equilibrium models of complex systems and processes are like this. To capture the contrary trend, characterized by self-reinforced errancy, flight or escape, D&G coined the inelegant but influential term deterritorialization. Deterritorialization is the only thing accelerationism has ever really talked about. All right, so there's a lot there. Let's break that paragraph down a little bit. So first, we need to talk about the idea of territorialization. These territorialization and deterritorialization are key terms here. So territorialization is the idea that you're going to limit the feedback of something to make sure that it does not go overboard. It does not escape the parameters that you've set for it. So he gives the idea of a governor on a steam engine here, right? Or on a thermostat, right? So you have a process that is making steam or heating your house. But of course, if it goes too far, if it continues to do the process without any regulation, that will have an undesirable effect. Even though technically the purpose of your steam engine is to boil enough water to create enough steam, or the purpose of your thermostat is to heat your house, that's not the ultimate goal of the thing, right? Because the thermostat, both the thermostat and steam engine, are actually serving a human purpose. You want the steam engine to make enough steam to go ahead and drive your boat forward, but not enough to blow up your boat. You want your thermostat to create enough heat to go ahead and heat your home, but not so much that it boils you or damages itself, lights your house on fire. So even though part of its job is creating a heat, a reaction, if it does that job too well, if it does it without any regulation, if you don't territorialize and limit that process within a specific range, it stops being useful to the humans that set it in motion, and instead it becomes dangerous to them, right? And so we can recognize that a process that is useful, as long as it is limited to a particular area that is helpful for people, is good. But once that process is allowed to continue beyond a certain point, then it's going to go ahead and become detrimental. It's going to escape its original purpose. And so when we talk about territorialization, we're talking about limiting the feedback of a process to keep it within the desired range. In our examples here, and I think what's most importantly, because you'll see it, this is going to impact humans a lot, we want to limit it inside its usefulness to humans, to the people who deployed it. Because if it continues that process and escapes that, things get bad. And so the word for it escaping that process, escaping that limited feedback, is called deterritorialization. And when things are deterritorialized out of their limited sphere, instead put into this state of constant feedback, they tend to get out of control. In social historical terms, the line of deterritorialization corresponds to uncompensated capitalism. The basic, and of course, to some real, highly consequential degree, actually installed schema is a positive feedback circuit within which commercialization and industrialization mutually excite each other in a runaway process from which modernity draws its gradient. Karl Marx and Friedrich Nietzsche were among those to capture the important aspects of this trend. As the circuit is incrementally closed or intensified, it exhibits ever a greater autonomy or automation. It becomes more tightly autoproductive, which is only what positive feedback already says, because it appeals to nothing beyond itself. It is inherently nihilistic. It has no conceivable meaning beside self-amplification. It grows in order to grow. Mankind is its temporary host and not its master. Its only purpose is itself. All right, so there's a lot there. And I understand he invoked Karl Marx, so there's going to be some in capitalism, so there's going to be some concern here. To be clear, Nick Land was a Marxist, and he definitely took a right-wing, a very hard right-wing turn. But he's definitely using that language. And it is important to note that there is some insight to draw here, even if we are not ourselves Marxists, even though Marxism is very evil in its implementation. Communism is particularly horrific. There are some important insights about modernity to draw here from what is being said. All right, so what's he talking about? What he's saying is that capitalism needs to be tied to a set of people if it's not going to run away, right? So the creation of things, the creation of goods in a marketplace, if it uncouples itself from if it's deterritorialized out of its service to particular peoples and instead works for its own good, creates one of these ungoverned feedback loops that he was warning about, the cybernetic feedback loop that constantly is exciting itself. So when he says commercialization and industrialization mutually excite each other, what he's talking about is that the commercialization process interacts with the development, right? Technological development and the creation of these things. And they start, if they interact with each other all by themselves without a interest in the humans that they're supposed to serve, if humans are cut out of the decision-making process, they start to excite themselves and start to run away from themselves. And this is what modernity draws its gradient from. This is what creates the direction of globalization. The process he's describing here is globalization. It's the idea that if capital stops serving the people of a nation and serves itself, the inevitable result is globalization, right? Because the capital no longer cares, the production of this, the commercialization and production no longer care about the specific people they were designed to serve. Instead, they only serve themselves. Now, you might say, okay, that's super abstract. Give me something concrete. No problem. So, for instance, we look at companies destroying the towns that they used to serve, right? You look at these companies who leave the towns that they used to serve a wasteland, right? These companies were originally designed to go ahead and create jobs and products for the people of the country, right? Is my American auto company is here to serve America and to create cars and create jobs. And yes, it's there to make money, but it's fundamentally serving particular people and it cares about its community, right? However, as the incentives line up, if you only care about the making of the money and you don't care about the people you're serving, then you start to deterritorialize, because the things that limited the capitalist experience were its desire to help particular people. So if you stop caring about helping particular people, you stop caring about the country you serve, the people you serve, the community you serve, the employees, your customers, and instead you only care about the money, then you start to make decisions that no longer factor in those humans, right? I only care about the money I'm making. I don't care about anything else that my company used to do. Well, what starts to happen? Well, you start saying things like, well, maybe I go ahead and move my factories offshore because I don't really care about the jobs I used to provide anymore. I only care about bringing down the cost of my car. And maybe you say, well, I'm going to cut these safety features because they're too expensive. And I don't really care about the customers using my car. I only care about the money I can make. And yeah, you know, maybe there's some market feedback where people stop buying my cars because they're more dangerous. But overall, I'm going to stop making decisions based on the people and the actual consequences to them. And I'm only making the decisions about what the market will bear. And so if I can get away with putting more people in danger to make more money, then I will. I mean, if I can't, then I'll put in the safety features. But overall, my motivation is the money and not the actual people. And so therefore, we start to see the capital deterritorialize. That car company starts moving its factories overseas, and the investors and the CEOs start moving their money into offshore banks, right? And they try to avoid as much as possible any ties directly to the nation itself, because the ties to the nation create restrictions. They try to avoid paying as many taxes as they can. All of these things, right? They go ahead and deterritorialize this as much as possible. And all of a sudden, they're not making the car, American cars, for the things that Americans want, but they start to spread their business to other places, right? Well, what about the Europeans? What about people in India? What maybe we need to go ahead and change the product we make for them. And over time, all of these things completely remove the human element, and they're only making decisions based on what can make more money and with no ties to the actual people they're supposed to serve. And so this, at every step that you dehumanize the decision-making process, you instead make it more automatically, make it more automatic. It's self-exciting. It feeds back into itself. And this is why we see insane things like the fact that we like don't make antibiotics or things in the United States, right? Because we found this out during the pandemic. We don't make critical medical equipment. Why? Because we don't care about the United States as such. The companies only care about making money. And so the fact that all of your drugs that you need to maybe solve some pandemic are made in the very country that created that pandemic, it doesn't matter to that company anymore because they're no longer tied in any way. They're no longer territorialized. There's no limiting factor on them. They're just running away, right? And so that's the process that they're talking about, is that everything is becoming less human and it starts automating itself as this continues. Let's dive back into our essay here. Accelerate the process, recommend Deleuze and Guattari in their Anti-Oedipus, in the 1972 Anti-Oedipus, citing Nietzsche to reactivate Marx. Although it would take another four decades before accelerationism was named as such, critically by Benjamin Noyes, it was already there in its entirety. The relevant passage is worth repeating in full. All right, so these guys are Marxists, right? So they want to get rid of capitalism. They don't like the capitalist process. And so their answer, they said, rather than trying to destroy capitalism, what we should be doing is accelerate globalism, accelerate this deterritorialization. If we can just accelerate the speed at which capital is not bound to any particular nation or even to the human experience, the faster we can go ahead and guarantee its own destruction. Now, this goes back to the actual, remember I told you this would have some overlap with political accelerationism. So what they're suggesting is we can't defeat capitalism in its current form, but if we can accelerate it out of its like governed territorialized form into this deterritorialized form, then we can go ahead and solve this problem by collapsing it that way. And so as Marxists who want to see this process collapse, that's what they're suggesting. Now, this quote here from Noyes is very interesting. Let's go ahead and read that real quick. Which is the revolutionary path? Is there one? To withdraw from the world market, as Samir Amin, probably the right way to say that, I don't know, advises the third world countries to do in a curious revival of the fascist economic solution? Or might it be to go in the opposite direction, to go still further, that is, in the movement of the market, of decoding and deterritorialization? For perhaps the flows are not yet deterritorialized enough, not decoded enough from the viewpoint of a theory that is a practice of a highly schizophrenic character. Not to withdraw from the process, but to go further in, to accelerate the process, as Nietzsche put it, in this matter, the truth is that we haven't seen anything yet. All right, so what he's talking about there, and many people don't know this because in our today's world, fascism is just this catchword, right? It's kind of a contentless word. It just means evil. However, most people don't know that fascism is a specific reaction to political and economic liberalism. Like Marxism, was attempting to stop this process. However, it had a different solution. Its solution was to completely withdraw from the world market, to go ahead and try to, as much as possible, limit its impact on society. They saw that capitalism had a tendency towards globalization, and they did not like that. They did not want that. And so their idea was to go ahead and remove that as much as possible. And many Marxists at this point were saying, well, maybe, you know, these third world people, these third world countries, if they don't want to go down this capitalist route, if they want to unhook themselves from the world market, then their solution could be this economic isolationism, right? That they could actually go back to the fascist solution. However, he's suggesting that instead, perhaps again, it's to accelerate that process, to go ahead and break it down as thoroughly as possible so that it collapses in on itself. Back to Land's essay here. The point of an analysis of capitalism or nihilism is to do more of it. The process is not to be critiqued. The process is the critique, feeding back into itself as it escalates. The only way forward is through, which means further in. All right, so this is a very fascinating passage here, this couple sentences here, because we actually see this all the time, right? So for instance, people will often point out correctly that Marxists will try to sell things. They'll try to market different products. And for instance, someone was just making fun of Hassan Piker today. I'm not super familiar with him, but I know he's a streamer. I think he's related to Cenk Uygur from the Young Turks. And he was like selling his, capitalism in decay merchandise, which is pretty hilarious, right? Like I'm going to go secure the bag. I'm going to make a bunch of money by selling merch on my website about how capitalism is over. However, this is Dick Land kind of capturing that this would happen, right? He was capturing that this would happen by saying that if you have a critique of capitalism, you're actually going to just end up doing more of that. And we can see this over and over again, right? I'm a Marxist. Go contribute to my Patreon, right? Like these kind of things. I've got to crank out more episodes so I can sell you another storyline about how we're just on the edge of the revolution. Now go buy some more of my merch, right? This is something that you would expect. And what he's saying here is that there really is no escape from this acceleration of capital. And even your attempt to critique it will simply do more of it. It'll just create more of the thing that you are trying to critique, the thing that you're trying to fight against. It's feeding back into itself. It's feeding back into that feedback loop. It's creating the cybernetic feedback loop that already accelerates what's happening. Back to the essay here. Marx has his own accelerationist fragment, which anticipates the passage from Anti-Oedipus remarkably. He says in an 1848 speech on the question of free trade, he's quoting Marx here, "In general, the protective system of our day is conservative, while the free trade system is destructive. It breaks up old nationalities and pushes the antagonism of the proletariat and the bourgeoisie to the extreme point. In a word, the free trade system hastens the social revolution. It is this revolution. It is in this revolutionary sense alone, gentlemen, that I vote in favor of free trade." All right. So we can see what he's pointing out here is from the beginning, Marxism, and a lot of people forget this about Marx because Marxism tended to only take hold in these third world countries. Marx's original prediction was that capitalism would collapse into Marxism, that capitalism would destroy itself. It would go too far. Its contradictions would overwhelm itself. And then the necessary communist revolution would come out of these capitalist bourgeoisie nations. And I know I'm saying that wrong. There's the right way to say it, but I always mispronounce it. People yell at me. We move on. I can't speak French. Here we go. So the collapse of these things was supposed to be the way that Marxism took hold. But of course, Marx was wrong. Marxism is wrong. Marx failed, right? And we can see that because the places that Marxism actually took hold were all these third world nations that needed to accelerate their development. So what you notice is that China and Russia become Marxist and not places like England or the United States, the places that you would expect to become Marxist. And that's because Marxism failed as an economic theory, but what it succeeded in was creating an alternative form of modernization for third world countries that didn't want to join the liberal world order. So if you're Russia or you're China and you want to go ahead and modernize at a high rate, but you don't want to join the United States and England and others in the liberal world order, you pick Marxism, not because it's economically sound. In fact, we found out it was economically disastrous, but because it allows you to basically centralize power and modernize as rapidly as possible by kind of just grasping everything, grasping the means of production and smashing them until you can go ahead and start cranking out AK-47s. And a space program. And so Marxism failed in the economic sphere. And so what we see here is in many ways, Marx encouraged free trade, right? Because what Marx did notice, and he's got some points here, guys, whether you like it or not, is that free trade actually causes a problem for nations. Marx wanted to destroy nations. He did not like them, right? That's the whole point here. And so they want to get rid of nationalism. They want to get rid of nationalities of the nation state. And so what's the best way to do that? Well, you go ahead and accelerate their deterioration through free trade. And so he says free trade causes a problem for the existence of nations. And because I like that, I like the antagonism it creates inside the proletariat. I like the fact that it goes ahead and creates this animosity between the proletariat and the bourgeoisie. I want to accelerate that. And so in this case, in this way, I am a free trader. And that was Karl Marx basically prefiguring the idea of accelerationism, that he would indulge in the acceleration of capital only to the point where he thinks it's going to go ahead and collapse itself. So back to the essay here. In this germinal accelerationist matrix, there is no distinction to be made between the destruction of capitalism and its intensification. The auto-destruction of capitalism is what capitalism is. The creative destruction is the whole of it. Besides only its retardations, partial compensations, and inhibitions, capital revolutionizes itself more thoroughly than any extrinsic revolution possibly could. If subsequent history has not vindicated this point beyond all question, it has at least simulated such a vindication to a maddening degree. So what he's saying there is that for many of these Marxists, the thing they kind of arrived at is we can't defeat capitalism. Like, capitalism is basically not going to be dismantled. And so it's the only thing that's going to kind of pull apart the tensions of capitalism is to accelerate it, to move it beyond its caring about the individual and the family, the community, and the nation, and to accelerate it to the point where it no longer serves those things, and it creates this globalism, and that is going to create so many problems that it will kind of collapse in on itself, right? And he says, to some degree, obviously, we can look at the globalization process and realize there's some truth to this, right? That, again, Marx's solution is terrible, and it's been proven entirely wrong. However, the problem that if capital is deterritorialized, if it decouples itself from the people it's supposed to serve, from the nations it's supposed to serve, from the communities it's supposed to serve, if it removes itself from its original human purpose and is allowed to accelerate on its own, it does create many of the problems that Marx and others anticipated. Their desire to accelerate that process is the desire to destroy nations, right? Is to destroy the what we understand as kind of good social order. And so that's why Marx wanted uninhibited capitalism, at least for a short time, because he hoped that its meltdown process would then bring about his revolution that he wanted so much. Now, here he's going to dive into the differences between left and right accelerationism, and this gets pretty into the weeds. If you would like to read this essay for yourself, I would go ahead and encourage you to do so. But this is going to get a little particular, and some of this is kind of no longer relevant. He wrote this essay a while ago, and so I think that's going to fly over our head. But in some ways, but I will go ahead and jump to this paragraph here. He says, capital in its ultimate self-definition is nothing besides the abstract accelerative social factor. Its positive cybernetic schema exhausts it. Runaway consumes its identity. Every other determination is shucked off as an accident at some stage of its intensification process. Since anything able to constantly feed social historical acceleration will necessarily by its essence be capital, the prospect of any unambiguously left accelerationism gaining serious momentum can be confidently dismissed. Acceleration is simply the self-awareness of capitalism, which has scarcely begun. So he's saying that the left-wing understanding of accelerationism basically ends up failing. It's not actually going to do its job. And so he ends up siding with a right-wing version of accelerationism. Again, a little beyond what we're talking about today. But then he says, as blockchains, drone logistics, nanotechnology, quantum computing, computational genomics, and virtual reality flood in, drenched in ever higher densities of artificial intelligence, accelerationism won't be going anywhere unless ever deeper into itself. To be rushed by the phenomenon to the point of terminal institutional paralysis is the phenomenon. Naturally, which is to say completely inevitably, the human species will define this ultimate terrestrial event as a problem. to see it is already to say we have to do something, to which accelerationism can only respond, you're finally saying that now, perhaps we ought to get started. It's in its colder variants, which are those that win out, it tends to laugh. All right, so what he's saying there is that accelerationism is not going away, as we can see by the number of technologies that have continued to collapse our decision space, continue to accelerate as our world only gets more interconnected and decisions impact more and more people simultaneously. The ability to make actual decisions starts to fall apart. And so this is not going away. And again, we can see the way that this impacts the world around us. The fact that our leaders can recognize certain problems, right? We're starting to figure out that mass immigration, that open borders is a problem. We're starting to figure out that having companies that don't care about family formation, having governments that don't care about the next generation, don't care about human concerns is an issue. But we don't really know what to do about it. For the left, it's just kind of like, oh well, let's tax it or something, right? Like they ultimately side with the globalization. They kind of want the one world community. They want anyone to be able to move here. They want the free flow of people and capital to continue. Really, at the end of the day, they just want to be able to milk it for as much power as they can. And the right is starting to recognize the problems that this causes for the nation. But they don't understand how you could limit it, because any understanding of how you could limit it would require us to make decisions that would limit our ability to, say, use particular technologies. We would have to reconnect corporate profits and the actions of corporations with the good of the nation, with the good of the community, the people it's supposed to serve. We might have to limit certain practices. We might have to reground the decisions that we make about the way that we create businesses or communities to actual people in the way they live. But each of these things would limit the ability for the line to go up, right? So in our line go up culture, in our line go up even conservatism, it's hard for us to think about actually limiting these processes back to serving specific people. And so that is the problem that accelerationism presents to us. We have an ever accelerating world. We have a world that is more connected, where technology and capital feedback to themselves constantly interact with each other, move things faster and faster. And we are just starting to recognize that that is an issue. But we have made our deliberating bodies as distributed as possible, so they're getting worse and worse at dealing with that very problem. And we have we're running out of time to actually go ahead and investigate that problem. So. No immediate solutions here, obviously. Sorry, this is not a happy fun time essay, but it is something that matters, right? And it helps us think about the way that we should be addressing these issues, if these issues can even be addressed at a civilizational level. I think the ultimate answer to this is actually localization. It's the understanding that these decisions won't be solved globally, that this process is probably going to run away to some extent no matter what. And the best thing that we can do is go ahead and make our communities stronger, make our states stronger, make our families stronger, make all of these things more resistant and resilient, because this process seems like it's going to escape the ability of our decision makers to go ahead and do anything about it. I mean, obviously, Joe Biden's not going to fix any of this stuff. And if you look at the Republicans, it doesn't feel like they have any solution to these problems either. However, if we localize this stuff, if we stop exploding the world, if we stop interconnectivity as much as possible, so we can, we might be able to go ahead and make things better for our own families, our own communities as much as possible. All right, guys, I'm going to go ahead and switch over to the questions of the people here. Jesse D says, the Jesus movement, moral majority, liberty U, apocalyptic, shaped our world from support for Israel to abandonment of the future, made patriotism absurd. Yeah, there's a lot there. I will say this, it certainly helps if our nation is considering its own well-being first. I find it kind of absurd that we have a political movement that says it's for America first, but doesn't do so. I don't think our money should go to Ukraine. I don't think our money should be going to Israel. I don't think our money should be going to foreign nations at all. I think that our money should be staying here. The same with our military, the same with everything that we can. Our efforts should be focused on making America and its people as prosperous and healthy and safe and give them the best lives that they can have. And the fact that the, you know, many in the conservative movement seem very interested with the well-being of other nations that are not our own to the detriment of our own does seem to make that brand of patriotism somewhat of an absurdity. Let's see here. Gruber Weirdo says, I was always under the impression that Land was spewing literal commie gobbledygook. I never really understood it, though. That was my impression. Yeah, and to some extent, that's true. Obviously, we can see the Marxism that is certainly tinged in there. Like I said, Land has taken quite a journey on this, to be sure, but that is certainly somewhere in his analysis. I've seen Land say that the reason he used so much of this language it was the language of the academy at the time. And so that's kind of just the soup he was swimming in. I think that's true to some extent, but I think also he probably, having read some of his earlier essays, believed in that stuff pretty heavily at the time. So maybe that's a little bit of cope on his part. But that said, you're right that some of that's there, but I do think there's value in what we're looking at here. I think it does say something important about the problem that we're facing, even though obviously, as we say, the Marxist solutions are horrific and should not be followed at all. Let's see. Creeper Weirdo says, it's like he's describing AI art. That's spooky. Yeah, isn't it? Right? It's remember this essay, I want to say it was written, it's at least a decade ago, maybe more. And so it's interesting how predictive it is, right? So I think there is some merit to it in its ability to predict certain phenomena. Again, that you don't have to take the whole thing to heart, guys. Just because we explore an idea does not mean that you have to swallow it whole, that you have to embrace all aspects of it. But you know, I want to bring these different sources to you. That's part, I think, why people come and watch this show as opposed to others is, you know, if you want to get the news of the day, if you want someone screaming about Candace Owens or something right now, you can go do that. There's a lot of people doing that. There's plenty of people talking about whatever, what's going on. And, you know, that's a legitimate service for a lot of people to provide. But I try to bring in some, you know, some out of the box stuff so people can explore it. But that doesn't mean that you have to go ahead and jump into everything that we look at with both feet. There are certainly things I disagree with Nick Land on. That doesn't mean that his insights aren't valuable. But that also doesn't mean I need to follow every step that he's taking. Creepy Weirdo says fascism equals not leftism and therefore bad. Yeah, that is very much the formulation. Anything that's not leftism is fascism, and therefore everything that opposes leftism is the worst thing ever, because we know that that's the worst thing ever. All we can do is debate these movements from last century. We can't have any understanding of our current situation. We just keep screaming about dead ghosts. Florida Henry says, are we just now seeing that we are trapped in the beginning of a dystopia? Yeah, so, obviously that language is pregnant with a lot of meaning. I think it means that we're going through a process, right? And one of the things to understand is that many times throughout history, civilizations have gone through great changes and upheavals, right? And those changes are only accelerating as our technology and other things accelerate. We've moved through different modes of production, economic understandings, social arrangements throughout, you know, many different times in history. And oftentimes those changes are violent and not good for the people involved with them. We don't want to encourage that. Again, that's why I'm not for political accelerationism. However, we should probably understand that we're not immune from that process. One of the things, again, that I try to get people away from is this idea that America is in this like magical bubble where we're never going to run into these problems. We're never going to face any of these issues that have impacted people throughout history. And so, yeah, we might be on the cusp of a serious revolution in the way that certain things about our society work. Does that make it a dystopia? Maybe, to some extent. Maybe it just means that things are going to look very different than they did previously in certain areas, and we need to prepare ourselves for that. But but I don't think that that means that things have to be terrible. The thing to always remember is that you can only really control the sphere around you, right? And as much as the, you know, Jordan Peterson clean up your room thing is a cliche, there's a lot of truth in it, right? These are the things that you these are the only things that you can control. That doesn't mean that the things around you don't matter. It doesn't mean that you're not going to be impacted greatly by world historical forces. But, you know, as Oswald Spengler said, optimism is cowardice. You know, basically, get over it, right? Like, you're not the first person to be in a difficult situation. There's a lot of people who have been in difficult situations, and they still met them with a great degree of virtue and valor and strength. And you need to do the same thing. You don't get to escape the turn of the wheel. And that can be a little concerning when we were watching, you know, our parents or grandparents enjoy some of the highest levels of prosperity throughout human history. And we thought that, like, we were just going to get to enjoy that too. But, you know, that we may not be there. You know, that may not be your ultimate fate, but that's okay. You know, that's all right. That's not the end of the world, in the same way that the fall of the Roman Empire wasn't the end of the world. You know, it certainly wasn't the time perhaps that you wanted to be born into. It's maybe not the greatest thing, but that doesn't mean that you as a person can't be virtuous. It doesn't mean that you can't build, you know, strong families, strong communities. It doesn't mean that you can't live a meaningful life. And so I think that that's always the same thing to keep in mind, even when we talk about how change is inevitable and some of it might not be so great. Alexandre Jean says, without Catholicism, the West is dead. I'm not a Catholic. I don't know that that's necessarily the case. America has always been a Protestant nation. Maybe you would say that's America's problem. There's, you know, you can make those arguments if you like. I would say that that without Christianity, that is certainly the case. I think that is the defining trait and identity of what most people mean when they say the West. They're really referring to Christendom. I think without that, I think you certainly are in a very serious state. He also follows up with, don't you think a return to tradition will fix our problem? The Enlightenment activists tore down that which came before. Now the moderns are doing the same thing. It will certainly help. So I think there's two things to think about here. I think that the strict return to tradition line is kind of a failure in the sense that you can never truly go back to something. You can never truly return to a past. That's not how things work. You cannot, and you know, we are creatures of our own time. We have to face the problems and solve the problems of our own times. We can draw wisdom and strength from traditions, and there are certainly eternal truths that are encapsulated in traditions that continue into our own times. And the dismantling of those traditions is a large part of our problem. You're right about that. At the same time, I think that for traditions to survive, and this is from Alasdair MacIntyre, philosopher who I like quite a bit. He says that they have to confront their crises and they have to be able to, you know, go ahead and overcome those crises and move forward. To prove the robustness of a tradition is for it to go ahead and meet the problems of a new generation and overcome them. And I think we're going to find that here. I think we're going to find, and I think in many ways we're starting to find, that many of the traditions that we dismantled, traditions like the family, traditions like the nation, were critical. And they were ones that were necessary. And the fact that we dismantled them is causing us a large amount of problems. And a return in some sense to those traditions is critical. However, even when we return to them in some sense, it will still be a version of them that is addressing the issues of our time. So the truths of those traditions will continue forward. But the way that we assign them, the way that we go ahead and act them out and live them out in our kind of modern problem, to address our modern problems, will be unique to our time. And so in that way, they will be new, they will be modified in some sense, but that is always true of traditions. No traditions are eternal in the sense that they never, ever, ever change. But they are eternal in the sense that they contain a way of being, an archetype that is necessary to human flourishing. And so to the extent in which we will return to things that are bettering our human flourishing, we will return to tradition. The idea that we will simply return to the traditions, you know, one-to-one of a previous time without any modification and understanding of our current modern scenario or problems I think is that one is incorrect. I think that being completely stuck in the past is a problem. As Nick Land would say, the only way out is through. And so I think we are going to have to face modernity and its challenges and post-modernity and its challenges. But we will face them with the eternal truths that tradition provides us. All right, guys, let's go ahead and wrap things up. Thank you, everybody, for coming by. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. Of course, if this is your first time on the channel, make sure that you go ahead and subscribe to the YouTube channel. Turn on those notifications and click the bell so you can catch these streams when they go live. Of course, if you'd like to get these broadcasts as podcasts, make sure that you go ahead and subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast network. And when you do, leave the rating or review. That really helps with the algorithm. And guys, if you'd like to go ahead and pre-order my book, The Total State, which will be coming out May 7th, you can do so on all your favorite retailers, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million. It's there. Many large retailers for you to pre-order. Thank you once again, guys, for watching. And as always, I'll talk to you next time.